Okay, this is part four of the Covenant of Life Opened. In this section, we're going to cover chapters 8, 9, and 10. Chapters 8 and 10 in particular are short. Chapter 9 is a little bit longer, but it's not nearly as long as chapter 7. 7 was a much longer chapter. So we're going to be looking at a number of questions regarding the covenants of works and of grace. Rutherford wants to make clear, first of all, as we're going to see, what the place of death is in the covenant of works versus covenant of grace. He's trying to help us see a little bit how things change as you move from one to the other. And there are a number of interesting points that he's going to raise in these chapters. I'm going to try to go point by point through them so we can get a pretty good survey of the material. So chapter 8, question 159, what are the subjects of the 8th chapter? The subjects are threefold. Number 1, or A, what place death hath in the covenant. As I say that, we're going to see he's talking about covenant generally taken. Specifically covenant of works and covenant of grace and how that'll be different. Number 2 or B, what such as Cain and Judas are to do in their desperate state, being reprobates, what should they do? What should be their response to their situation? And number 3, why the Lord is nowhere called the God of Adam. So each of these, I think, is somewhat loaded. Each has significance for where he's going to take us as the book unfolds. Question 160 then, the first question addressed is, what room hath death in the covenant? So, he says, really, we have to consider this first. His answer, 161, he says, under the covenant of works, we have to think of the of death as the sergeant of revenging justice. Now, part of this has to do with the fact that original sin and death enter into the world through the covenant of works. And there's an unwillingness to die. What's Hebrews 2:15? The bondage through fear of death, which is the law staying in death. So that's the one aspect the death has in the covenant of works. But then he says, look, under the covenant of grace, it's now, death is now the king's ferry boat to carry the children over the water. That is to bring them when they're summoned before God. And he says it's not they're not being legally summoned. Under covenant of grace, you're not being legally summoned, right? And here again, he points to Philippians 1:23, where Paul says that he would, he desires to die, right? But it's better that he live for the church. So the sting is clearly gone out of death for the apostle. And he understands that. So there's that difference. All right, 162, the next question advanced is, what room hath life in the covenant? We consider what the room of death. Now, he says, think about the room of life in the covenant, or the place of life in the covenant. So 163, his answer. He says, in a law covenant, in administration of law covenant, the covenant of works, he says, there's first habitual holiness of works, and then a crown. That is, first there's obedience, and then there is a reward for that obedience. But in the covenant of grace, he says, there's first faith and title to Christ, who is our life and hope of glory. Then, he says, there is habitual holiness, which is begun here and is perfected hereafter. He says, gospel life is both the reward and duty of praising and loving eternally in place of all the Ten Commandments of law and gospel. So 164, what question comes under consideration next? He wants to consider if Adam, in the interval between his fall and the publishing of the blessed seed, whether or not he was to despair or not, or simply rely upon God as mighty to save. And in addition to that, what should such as Judas and Cain do? So 165, what rules are laid down for those who are despairers? You know, should they despair? Rutherford says, first of all, the conscience of Cain and all despairers should recognize that they're no way authorized to rely upon their conscience over the promises held out in God's word. In other words, even though you are in this position where you are between, hanging as it were, between heaven and earth, or heaven and hell, you've fallen, but you don't have yet a promise of a redeemer. Rutherford is saying that's still no reason for despair. Right, because you you are in no way authorized to rely upon your conscience over what's revealed. Sorry. Two, he points out that there's no spirit of God bidding them to despair. We're bidding them to write themselves in what he calls the black rolls of reprobates. It's as though they believe in hell, they don't have a right to kindle its fire before night. And three or C, and I think this is an interesting thing that he points out. Remember, we're talking about that period of time between the fall and the publication of the gospel. And should you fall into despair, being in a fallen state there? And he says, look, being under the law of nature, because that doesn't cease when they fell, they should still rely upon the infinite mercy of God, which they should know is able to save. So the idea here is this. In the case of Adam, between the fall and the publication of the gospel, he still has the light of nature, right? And so he should be relying, by reason of the light of nature, he should be relying on infinite mercy, which is able to save him. And by analogy, someone like Judas or Cain ought to do the same. Now, there's a sense in which the gospel has been published, but not necessarily directly to them. Right? They haven't heard with the hearing of faith, and so it hasn't been, in a sense, published to them. But they still don't have a ground for assuming that they're reprobate. And this is a problem, really. You know, you can have assurance of salvation, but the point here is you can never be assured of your reprobation. Right? It's possible that you end up like the thief on the cross, who's saved at the very last moment. You just don't know. Right? So the reprobate can't have assurance of reprobation. They can certainly have intimations. And as Rutherford's going to point out, they should certainly fear being in an unsaved state. All right, 166, what comments are given to weak doubters? He says, think about this. When doubting, you're closer to natural light than to spiritual light. And therefore, faith must be set on worked acts of faith. Because faith acts most strongly when reason is weakest. And he says, for example, fire burns hotter in the winter frost, things of that sort. A second thing that he points out here is, if you're a doubter, you have to recognize there is a certain amount of unseen willfulness in your unbelief. You are not just not believing, but there is this blind impulsion of will in unbelief that creates this resistance in you. So it's not really simply a matter of, you know, I can't believe or I don't believe. It's also a matter of I don't want to believe. It's always that too. And Rutherford is saying you need to recognize that. You need to own that. Right. Three, or C, if you're a doubter, you have to do as God commands and believe. And he gives a good example here. He says, look, should God command killing your son like he did with Abraham, which would seem to contradict the whole gospel of the promised seed, yet he says, knowing it comes from God, Abraham does well to leave the contradiction, the supposed contradiction, to be solved by God. So, he says, we're to believe that God will provide for us whether he does or he doesn't, to our seeming. But he's promised he will. And if it doesn't look that way to us, well, look again. But you're still to believe. And you're to believe not because of what you see or what you perceive. Belief doesn't rest upon your senses, does it? It rests upon the promises of God. That's exactly what, by the way, makes a difference between standing in a covenant relation versus standing in a simple natural relation. Whether or not we are going to believe. And that brings us to the last question in this chapter. 167. Where was there a word that God was Adam's God? So, 168, what are the first two answers given? Well, he says, you know, keep in mind that there wasn't one directly. There wasn't any word directly to that effect. But he says, A, or first of all, he says, the covenant was like letters of the king. Which were raised to such a day, and the date being expired, the letters ceased to be in force. In other words, this covenant was expired with the fall, really. But two or B, he says, God was not his God. In the sense that he was required to give Adam the influences to obey. But God never said he would be Adam's God by giving him influences to obey and to obey to the end. All influence granted to Adam to will and do were granted to him. But they're granted to him in a in a peculiar sense. They're not given to him by reason of covenant. And this is what's important here to understand. So, 169. In what sense may we not say God is Adam's God? Well, we can say he's not Adam's God as a redeemer in the covenant of grace, but God creator. Two or B, the influences of grace then were free gifts, but they're not promised gifts. And that's important because promised gifts imply gifts that are reliant upon covenant. In the covenant of works, what is promised is contingent upon Adam's obedience. It's not promised in order to his obedience. So we can't say that the influences of grace here are covenant graces. They're simply graces freely bestowed or withheld, but they're not promised. And that brings us to 3 or C. The influences given in the garden then were natural and external. They're not like in the New Testament. A new heart. And all that is said to flow from that. So 170, what is the last answer Rutherford gives in this chapter? He says, look, the very threat, the threat of death to Adam, if he should sin, may infer a covenant of life. That is, that God should be Adam's God if he should obey. So again, what is he talking about? I think he's talking here about God as our God, right? There, again, the idea that God is Adam's God as creator, that doesn't imply anything gracious or necessitate anything gracious, nor does it infer any promise necessitate that there be any kind of personal relation. You know, when the Bible talks about God being our God, it's a lot more personal. You know, covenant is a means of God entering into, and it's condescension on the part of the divine, but entering into this very intimate personal relation with his creation. Remember, simply by reason of being created, Adam had a duty of obedience. Right? Whereas God had no obligation whatsoever to the creation. So God's relation is entirely voluntary, so that any influences of grace apart from covenant are simply given freely. There's nothing binding him to that. Now, by covenant, there's a promise made. And, you know, again, in the covenant works, the promise is, if you do this, I will do that. And that, Rutherford is saying, in the covenant of works, is already inferring that God is willing to enter into this very intimate and personal covenant relation to be Adam's God. So that's his point there. All right, let's move on to chapter 9. 171, what are the subjects discussed in the 9th chapter? First of all, what life is promised in the covenant of works. Second, or B, whether all we, especially the reprobate, whether all we, by the fall, lost all right to the creatures. And then third, or C, how the Lord is our God. So we're going to revisit that question that he left hanging there at the end of that the previous chapter. All right, 171. What's the first question advanced in this chapter? What is meant by life promised in the covenant of works? So he gives a couple of answers. 173. He says, first of all, understand that this is not a life in Christ and the fruit of the merit of blood as our life is in the new covenant. Here he references John 10:11. Take a look at John 10:11 and John 3:16. And I'm not giving you all the Bible verses here. There are a lot. In the previous chapter, there were quite a few, and here's some, but we'll look at a few.
John 10, verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep.
John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life.
Right. So, he's saying, in the covenant of works, it's not that life which Christ merited by his blood. Negatively speaking, we can't understand that life . He says, you know, in part, he goes on to say, Adam was not mediator of reconciliation here. But if he's mediator of anything, it's a law life to a communion in glory. All right, 2 or B, Rutherford says, the life he lived and the creatures for his service seem not to belong to this life. The creatures were given to Adam, him not working for them. And what he's saying is there's a different kind of life than we think of now. Things were already orderly. There were no vines overgrowing the garden. Right? There are no pests or storms to make us fight and struggle. So there is a sense in which this life is is pointing to something more, but
I
he's not really committed to how far this life is going to go under a covenant of works. But he says, look, it could be that there would be earthly blessings given to Adam as a reward for actual obedience, sort of at, like he says, sort of like you see in Deuteronomy 28. You know, if you do this, then that. If you do this, then that. If you don't, then this. Verse 74, what's the next question? He says, did Adam and all the reprobate who were in his loins lose the right to the creatures? Or, by which he means the creation. So he gives, by way of answering this, question 175, he gives answers. Three answers, he says. First of all, he says, we have to distinguish. He says there's a natural right. Second, there's a providential right. And third, or C, there's a spiritual right. So he first says in 176, two ways may a natural right be conceived. He says, first of all, you can conceive of it absolutely. So that creature and man not created can have no right or claim to being your life. The Creator's free gift is our best charter to life and being. So in an absolute sense, he's saying you don't really have a right to anything, naturally. But our best charter is really God's free gift. He's giving us life and being. That's it. But we don't have a claim to it, a right of claim. Right. Two, he says we can conceive of a natural right conditionally. So that he says it's as if God created a sun, and with that there's a power to give light, which is congruous to that. It's suitable to the nature of the sun, but the creature can't plead for this as a debt or as something owed to it. And he points out something here when he speaks of this condition. He says, think about this. Because there's no law and command to anything, to receive or not to receive, being in life from the Creator, there can't be any sin in receiving life and being from the Creator, right? Because where there's no law, there's no transgression. So having, being in life cannot be in itself sin, naturally. Now this is an important point he's making here. Right? Because it's going to get to the point of, you know, why the reprobate, as he's going to point out, they don't simply forfeit everything in this life. You know, we're not allowed to just shoot them and take their stuff simply because they're reprobate. Okay, we have other rules that come into effect here. All right. If there's something inherently unlawful or ungodly about, you know, their existence or being something sinful about it, that would be one thing. But Rutherford is saying there's not. It can't be sin for them not being in life simply because there is no command to receive or not to receive being in life from the Creator. So it's impossible for there to be transgression in so receiving. 177. What is a providential right? He says, a providential right is simply a continuating of life and being until the same power that gave it shall remove it by way of punishment. So he says, God as creator of his sovereignty gives being and life and the comfortable use of the creatures. But as a judge, ordinarily for sin, he removes it. And then he makes this point, which goes to something actually we've talked about in a different connection. He says, by the way, I don't deny out of his sovereignty he may and possibly does annihilate the meat that the angels in assumed bodies ate, or which the man Christ after the resurrection did eat. Just a point. He wants to make you understand that God isn't bound by justice. Remember that? So justice allows him to do, take these things away in punishment. But it does not necessitate that he do so. Furthermore, he might just take away these things purely as a matter of sovereignty. And that's why he brings up the issue of angels eating in their assumed bodies and the man Christ. Right. 3. 178. What is a spiritual right? Spiritual right is that new supernatural title which the elect believers have in order to a supernatural end. And all these things being made theirs to promote their salvation. So he looks at, we can look at 1 Corinthians 3:21. He says, all things are yours. Or Revelation 21:7, he that overcometh shall inherit all things. By covenant right, he says, and he says that because he adds, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. And he looks at from Psalm 37:10. So, 179, as to the second right, to the providential right, what are the points to be considered here? Because this is really what he says is the main controversy, the providential right. When we're talking about Adam and we're talking about the reprobate in particular. He says there are five things to consider. First of all, A, He says to enjoy life and being is in the substance of the act no sin. If there's nothing nothing about being born and living which is sin. Simply nothing there. Two or B, he says that if to eat and live or sin, he says, remember the elect are also born heirs of wrath as others. Ephesians 2:3. And if to eat and live are sin, then all the reprobate should kill themselves or be killed from the birth. But, you know, that would also seem to apply to the elect as they come forth from the womb. And that can't be. Three, or C, he says, the dominion of the reprobates over the creatures, or over the creation, is part of the good image of God. And they haven't so utterly lost the image of God as to be without some natural knowledge that there is a God, to honor their parents, to hurt no man, and so on. So this is, there's nothing sinful, inherently sinful in that. Now, he's not saying that they're not going to misuse the good gifts of God. After all, that's what wicked men do. It's the course of the reprobates. Four D. He says this opinion that the reprobate give up all of their right to life and being looks more like a fancy. It seems more like it's a temptation to weak people under a sad desertion. And he says this idea that we shouldn't do our duty because there might be sin adhering to it by reason of our corruption. You know, he says that sounds a lot like a satanic temptation that would drive everyone to suicide. That's a problem. And then 5E, he says, if the reprobate have lost all right to the creation, hey, then we can kill them and take everything they have, like I said at the beginning. But the problem with that is the law of God says no. In fact, he says that they have a like right to their life and goods as do all men. And he points out how weird it would get, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. What if that, you know, if it only applies to the elect? Doesn't really even get into the question of whether or not we can know really who is the elect. But anyway, he just says that this is contrary to the law of God. Right? We can't just go out because people are non-regenerate and kill them and take their stuff. So this idea that they've lost all right, all providential right, is misguided. They haven't lost their natural right, they haven't lost their providential right. Okay. They've never had a spiritual right. You can't have that apart from faith in Christ. Anyway. 180, then. What objection might be raised at this point? He says, well, somebody might object that those who enjoy that of which they deserve to be deprived have no due right to that of which they deserve to be deprived. But they're usurpers, and so they sin. And therefore, you could argue from that all the non-regenerate are such, because they're using that to which they have no right, and they sin in the act of using it. But Rutherford gives several answers to this. 181, the first answer he gives is this. He says, it's not universally true. He says, because only God can remove these things of the creation, life, eating, sleeping, etc., no one else, nor can you yourself take that away. You don't even have the right, frankly, to take away your own life. He says there's a difference, by the way, between people who enjoy basically stolen goods by their own private power, goods that they, by their own private power, could restore. He said, if you are enjoying stolen goods which by your own private power you could restore, that's one thing. Then you're sinning. Right. But he says, that's not the case here. Those who enjoy whatever it is of which by sin they deserve to be deprived is denied. He says, because life, being, eating, sleeping, such things can only be taken away by judicial power or by God, the Lord of life and death. And he points out, it's not lawful for a man to punish himself and to take away his own life, nor by any other, except it be for capital crimes. So they have a due providential right to keep and enjoy all such things until there's been an actual judicial finding. Now, 182, then, what's the second answer given to all of this? Says, I'm not. Says, touching the substance of the act of living, being, eating, drinking, it's most false that they deserve to be deprived of it. And they're not sinning in that. But, he says, in the way, manner, and end of living and eating and drinking, they do sin. Because they're to do all to the glory of God. 183. What's the question brought up at this point? This is, what way is God ours? That is, what way is He our Lord? There are four things, 184, things to be considered in this. He says, number one, He's ours by covenant. And He points to Ezekiel 34:24. Somebody wants to get that. Ezekiel 34:24. Genesis 17:7, Jeremiah 32:38, and Zechariah 13:9. So Ezekiel 34:24, Genesis 17:7, Jeremiah 32:38, and Zechariah 13:9.
Ezekiel 34:24, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken it. Genesis 17, verse 7, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee, and to thy seed after thee.
Jeremiah 32:38, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God.
Zechariah 13:9, and I will bring the third part to the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God.
And he's very clear. He's saying, understand, God is not ours as if we had some gifted right and dominion over Him like we have over the creatures. That's why it's important to understand. He's our God by covenant. He was our God simply by reason of being our Creator. It would be necessarily the case. And we're back to that whole question of, you know, necessity versus voluntariness in this relation. So He's ours by covenant. Two or B, He says, He's not ours like we're His. The clay has not sovereignty over the potter. Three or C says, God is not our God simply. He says, but our God, He's our God, as it were, coming down in Christ to us in covenant ways as God incarnate to make out His goodness, grace, and mercy to and for us. And then 4D, He says He is, it's true, God incarnate. Christ is principally God. So if you look at 1 Corinthians 3:21 for this point.
1 Corinthians 3:21. Therefore let no man glory in men, for all things are yours.
All things are yours, and everything is, you know, God. Christ is God's in this scheme of things that Paul sets out. So he says it's true. God incarnate Christ is principally God's, not ours. But he goes on to say He is our Emmanuel, God with us, in order to save us. And so he points out He's actually more our God than He is God of the angels. Because He becomes our God, how? By way of covenant. Right? The way that we're talking about here, the way we're concerned about here. We're not talking about Him simply as Creator. Right. 185. In what way is God to be the chief desire of the saints? Because God is to be the the greatest of the saints' desires, more to them than all heaven in length and breadth and all the inhabitants of heaven, more than all the angels and saints. God, the word he uses he says God is the fluier of the saints' desire, by which he means that all the saints' desire should flow unto him more than heaven and the inhabitants of it. So all your desire should be flowing there. He then goes on to, or B, says that just as there's no hell to Christ but to be afar off from God, and no heaven but the glory he had with the Father, so that should be the desire of the saints as well. And then 3 or C, he says there should be in this desire nothing more like a spiritual disposition than when the spouse in Song of Solomon 3 has soul love to Christ. I sought him whom my soul loved. Right. Which brings us to 186, the dispositions of the soul of the spouse to Christ. And the first one is, A, there's a soul love to Christ. The soul itself is caught up in this, is soul love. Two, or B, the spouse in the Song of Solomon has an ardent desire after him. I sought him, but I found him not. There's this ardent desire after him, after Christ. Three, or C, there has to be a diligent searching for him that comes from a strong faith. And then 4D, there's a love of the ordinances and means of grace. So if God is ours, then he's saying God is... he's ours by covenant. He's limited the ways in which we're to conceive of God as being ours. And he says, and then conversely, there's this other aspect we have to keep in mind, and that is our desires need to be toward him. Right? All of our desires have to flow toward him. So So what he's talking about, before I get into the question 187, what he's talking about here is the result again of God entering into covenant. Because God has entered into covenant, he's become our God. And this rising desire toward him is, it's really the result, or it should be the result, of him entering into covenant. I mean, if you really understand what he's doing here, which I think is why he's at such pains to tell us. All right, so what 187, what are the train of graces that he lists here? Okay, train of graces, again, quietness for lack of Christ. He says, number one, or A, there's an awakening of the heart, an awakening heart. This is, if you think about it, the reprobate don't have any kind of heart stirrings toward God or Christ. They're just not concerned. None of this means anything to them, really. Two or B, he said there's a discerning of the beloved. Three, there is a stirring of Christ's hand upon the keyhole of the heart. So saying your heart's awakened, you discern Christ, you now feel the stirring of his hand upon the keyhole of your heart, that is the lock that's on your heart. It's being opened by him. 4D, there's a moving of the bowels for him, by which he means, in a biblical sense, the emotions are set after him. Fifth, or E, so there's a seeking of him and a praying, but no finding nor an answer. And remember, this is a train of graces when they're still in quietness, because you still lack Christ, but you sense his presence, you know he's there, but you're not getting an answer. And that leads us to 6, or F, he says there's a love sickness or a missing of him. So 188, what ways do a spiritual soul act toward God, towards God? First, he says there his glory is the last end, or the chief end, and stirrer of us in all of our actings. And 2 or B, the spiritual soul actually misses God rather than the graces gotten from him. And then C, 3. These spiritual soul acts engage all that we are, hands, knees, body, self, to be for God, to live wholly for God. And D, 4, we're not to believe in believing, nor to be sick of love with love of Christ, nor to make a god of faith or love. It's spiritual condition to have grace and to miss Christ. So what he's saying there in the last one is, spiritual soul acting toward God is in love with Christ, not in love with faith or in love with love. And that's an important point, I think, particularly today when we have people who seem to be in love with faith or in love with love rather than in love with Christ. That's two different ends being contemplated altogether. To be in love with graces is a different thing than being in love with the one to whom all the train of graces should be leading it or drawing us. And this is a problem that I think many people face today. All right. Let's move on to the 10th chapter, question 189. The question considered in the 10th chapter is, what are the false grounds of the Lord's making the covenant of grace? So, Rutherford considers he's really striking hard in it's a very short chapter, but it's striking hard against Arminianism, and it's striking hard against certain certain notions that seem to lie behind Arminian doctrine. So I find some of the things he says, even though it's a short chapter, I find some of this not only deeply interesting, but also very much applicable to the situation we find ourselves in today. We're talking to people. A lot of people adopt these ideas and don't ever stop to think about what it is they're really saying or thinking. Anyway, Rutherford says that there are the false grounds. He says there are two bastard grounds devised by the Arminians. Right, so 190, question 190, what are the reasons behind the first bastard ground devised by the Arminians? So he says, look, the Arminians say, because the covenant of works cannot oblige to both an active and passive obedience, but only to one of them, and it was so rigid that God couldn't follow it out, because following it out would mean casting infants into hell, for sin which is theirs only by imputation, and was pardoned to the first man that committed it. Therefore, they say the covenant of works had to have been broken and the covenant of grace established because, you know, they just can't imagine God casting infants into hell for a sin that's only imputed to them. You know, they're not actual sin, it's only imputed sin. So you had to break this covenant of works. Had to be broken. Covenant of grace had to be set up. Brother's saying that's a false ground. It's a bastard ground. You know, as if God is constrained. Again, what lies behind this idea that God is constrained by our notion of justice. Or that God is constrained by justice at all. Which ultimately amounts to this, that God comes under some constraint by reason of his creating. So that the creation is not wholly and solely voluntary in its relation to God. It actually begins to impose conditions and demands upon God. I mean, that's, you know, we're going back to what we talked about in chapter 7, but this is the idea that the creation, the created order, can lord it over the Lord. Or 2 or B. He says they deny that there could be a mere casting into hell for those who never heard the gospel. So there has to be active disobedience. That's their whole thing where they're hung up on it having to be either active or passive. So it must be active, which gets us to the point where then infants can't, you know, be cast into hell because there's no active disobedience, right? Until we pass it. And then 3 or C, they say that the first covenant was holy and spiritual. God should unjustly threaten death upon infants if they're not guilty of eternal condemnation. Rutherford says in response to this, and you know, if there's no sin in infants, then there's no need for the ransom of his blood for them. But scripture does say infants are guilty of the sin. Ephesians 2:3, Romans 5, Psalm 51:5, Job 14:4. These are all verses that have to do with what we would call original sin or the imputation of sin. All right, 191, what is the second bastard ground given by the Arminians? They say that there's this natural antecedent desire and love of God to have all saved. In other words, there's a natural desire and love in God preceding everything to have all saved. And that moved him to make this covenant of grace with everyone. And Rutherford says, you know, this Arminian idea is actually the same as we're going to find in the Talmud and in the Quran and among the heathen. Like their idea of God is very similar to the unbelieving Jews, to the Muslims, and to the heathen. So, 192, what are the opinions of the non-Christians? Says it, this makes away the idea of free grace. It changes God as the Talmud. The Talmud says God has a secret place in which he afflicts himself because he destroyed the temple and delivered the Jews to captivity. This is kind of stupid stuff that the Jews say in the Talmud. This is why Luther wrote a book called The Jews and Their Laws, because they say stupid things like this in the Talmud. I'm not saying everything in the Talmud is stupid, but this is the kind of dumb thinking, dumb muddle-headed thinking.
Say it again.
That God has a secret place in which he afflicts himself because he destroyed the temple and delivered the Jews into captivity. So he did it, he had to do it, but, you know, he turns around after he does this, and he, in his secret place somewhere, he's, you know, flagellating himself and saying, oh, bad, 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 why did I do that? It's really no different, when you think about it, than what the Arminians are saying about God having this antecedent desire and love to have everyone saved. So the Arminian view is really no different than the Talmudic view of God. Two, or B, the Quran, or the Al-Quran as he calls it here, it says that God and the angels wish well to Muhammad, but they can't free him from death. You know, which again is very much like the Arminians. You know, I want you to be saved, but hey, I wish you well. There's not a whole lot I can do about it at this point. You know, I really want everyone to be saved, but you know, my hands are really tied at this point, and it's really up to you. So again, the Arminian view is very much in line with the Muslim view. So wonder that in a world that loves Arminianism and Pelagianism, that they don't have a problem with unbelieving Jews and Muslims. But 3 or C, he says, the heathen... heathen made their Jupiter, who was their chief god, to deplore the destinies that he couldn't amend. So again, Arminianism is not more than a handbreadth away from the heathen view of God. God is sitting back, and you know, he hates it. Man, he hates it. He wishes he could do something about it. He can't cross that line. You know, that would violate some principle of justice or some principle of integrity toward the creation. From their point of view, you know, again, all of this Arminianism, just like Talmudic Judaism, just like Islamic theology, just like heathen divinity and theology and spiritualism, all of these things, all of these religious views share this common theme, that God, by reason of creating, now comes under a debtor obligation to the creature. But they add to it this idea that it's a debtor obligation he can't really pay. No wonder so many people fall into a practical deistic view that, you know, God wound up the universe and he walked away and things are just continuing as they are. You know, there's no one in control of this madhouse. No wonder they look at it that way. You know, and as they look at it that way, God sends them strong delusion that they might believe the lie. Right? And so it looks more and more like the chaos that they imagine it to be. Sure it does, from their position, from their point. All right. 193, then, what does Rutherford conclude on this whole matter? Rutherford says that this whole Arminian outlook makes God appear to be helpless and out of control. And that destroys the power of grace, and it restrains the outgoings of free love. He's sorrowful, he's mourning, he can't really get what he wants, right? He can't get everyone saved. He wants it. He wishes you well. He hopes for you. You know, he's the God of the crossed fingers, right? Hoping against hope that perhaps, maybe, you might respond. Perhaps what he really wants will come to pass now and again. You know, again, this view is a view which subjugates the Creator to the creation, which makes the Creator, in some sense, hanging and dependent upon what happens in the creation. Because if it doesn't go his way, well, he's going to mourn. He's going to be sad. Like the Talmud said, he's going to cry out rivers of water and oceans of water, and he's going to beat his breast, and he's going to, decry all that's going on. He just doesn't have the ability to help. Where is this, in all of this, where is there really a God? And the reason they have this is because they've elevated the idea of good over God, right? They won't believe that God is sovereign. They would rather believe that God is powerless than believe that there's evil in this world and that God controls it. And a large part of this is because, you know, they fail to place the sinfulness of sin solely upon the agents of that sin, the sinful creatures. They have a very defective view of God. They have a very defective view of his covenants. And I'm not even sure how many modern-day Arminians like Arminius. And Rutherford there was actually interacting with Arminius, who still at least paid some lip service to a covenant of works. I'm not sure how many of them would even bother with that anymore. Right, so with that, we're finished now with those three chapters, and next time we'll pick up at chapter 11.